So hi, I'm Christy Balsall. I'm the Executive Director of Mitre Action. It is the 2nd of May in 2008, and this is our monthly meeting where our topic today is heat intolerance. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the causes and symptoms of heat intolerance, as well as some strategies to keep cool in the warmer temps. And I welcome all of you to share your ideas as well as interact with our guest speakers today. And as we're talking, my general rule of thumb is if you have a question that's very relevant to what one of our speakers or participants is talking about, then feel free to go ahead and speak up and ask your question. If you have a question that hasn't been yet addressed, I will give us a chance to open the floor and just bring up new topics and questions after we've had a chance to hear Maggie and Nancy talk with us. So that way we'll get a chance to address everybody's concerns and questions as well as to share ideas. So let me go ahead and let Maggie and Nancy introduce themselves. And thank you for being here today. I appreciate both of you being a part of our call. Maggie works with Dr. Corson at the Floating Hospital for Children at Tufts Medical Center. And Maggie, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll introduce Nancy as well.
Sure. Yes, thanks very much for inviting me here today. I'm the nurse coordinator in the metabolism service, as you said, at the Floating Hospital for Children at Tufts Medical Center in Boston. I've been working with the metabolic team at the Floating for 3 years, and before that I had many years of experience with mitochondrial disease.
Thank you, Maggie. And some people on the call know you, Maggie, because we were talking about what a gem you are before you got on the call. So
thank you very much.
This is Darla Klein. I was commenting on that. Do you remember who I am?
Yes, I do indeed.
So thanks, Maggie. And this is going to be a pretty casual environment today, but we're happy to have your experience to share with us. And Nancy, thank you for joining us today also. Would you take a second and introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm happy to be here. My name is Nancy Keene, and I'm a founder of Silver Eagle Outfitters. And we make cooling apparel. That's our primary line. We got into it 8 years ago. Our primary market has always been the motorcycle market and the canines, and those are our commercial markets. We've been helping people who are living with MS, multiple sclerosis, for many years. And then about 3 years ago, I had one mother contact me and say, you know, would you try making a small vest for my daughter? And I think that's where I had never, to be very honest, I had never heard of the disease. I didn't realize that people suffered such severe heat intolerances from it. So in the last couple of years now, we have been making vests for children. I get calls and letters from parents all the time saying, you know, it's just changed their child's lives. And we're just happy to be able to have a solution for, in particular, like I said, the children and, you know, as always, the adults. But it makes us feel good to be able to provide some help.
Great. So we're going to talk some specifics about those vests and the technology in a little bit. But let's first get started and talk a little bit about what is the heat intolerance and why is it a problem for people with mitochondrial disease. And Maggie, I'm going to turn it over to you to just talk a little bit about that with us.
Christy, may I ask? I'm not to interrupt. I need to hang up. And can I call back, though, on the microphone? Okay, thank you.
You can. If you hang up, just use the same code to call back.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
No problem. Okay, go ahead, Maggie.
Okay, hi. You know, it's heat intolerance, as I'm sure most of you know, is a very common symptom of the autonomic dysfunction that Dr. Holtzman discussed last month. So this is, not only is this a perfect time of year to be talking about this, but it's the perfect piggyback onto last month's topic. As he reviewed, dysautonomia is poor functioning of the autonomic nervous system, which regulates the body's response to very basic changes such as temperature, changes in body positioning such as sitting or standing, digesting food, blood pressure, heart rate. The autonomic nervous system regulates those things that that happen without our conscious awareness in the body. And dysautonomia causes some of the most distressing symptoms for patients with mitochondrial disease. It is very common for people with mitochondrial disease to have abnormal regulation of body temperature. They can have abnormal baseline body temperatures. They can have an inability to tolerate heat or cold. As you know, sweating is one of the ways that the body cools itself, and some patients with mitochondrial disease don't sweat. Some, on the other hand, sweat excessively. Patients often find that hot weather worsens their other autonomic symptoms, such as gut dysmotility, pallor, flushing, rapid heart rate. It can also worsen non-autonomic symptoms, such as seizures, fatigue, muscle cramping, behavioral changes. As I'm sure you know, many mitochondrial patients wilt in the heat. It's almost like a flower in your garden that hasn't been watered. You know, people just wilt. How do we manage that? And I think really the kind of the hallmarks of managing heat intolerance, as in so many other areas of mitochondrial disease management, are know yourself or your child and plan ahead. And I really can't overstate this, because you know yourself or your child better than anyone, and you know what you or your child can typically tolerate. If you go past what is doable, you know that you or your child will need recovery time. How much recovery time that is really depends on many factors, such as, you know, how severe or advanced the patient's mitochondrial disease is, if there's been a recent infection, how active was the patient in the heat, and similar factors. And just as with anyone, higher humidity makes it harder to tolerate a given temperature. And that's, you know, again, that's true for everyone, not just patients with mitochondrial disease. So some of it's sort of common sense, like don't go to Disney World in July, right? And everybody knows that already. Do that in the wintertime. And if you or your child will be active outside, try to minimize the time outside when the weather's hot and plan for some rest time afterward. But, you know, given all of that, now here in the Northeast, we're just starting to experience the warmer weather, but, you know, other parts of the country have been experiencing it for some time, like the 94-degree day we just heard about in Oklahoma. And really some of the basics are to stay well hydrated, make sure that you or your child is meeting your maintenance fluid requirement. There's a very simple formula for calculating that that's based on weight. And your pediatrician or your mito physician or mito nurse can easily let you know how much fluid your child requires. Many patients with mitochondrial disease have higher fluid requirements than healthy people. And just be aware that fruits and vegetables count as part of your fluid intake. It isn't just, you know, water and juices and things. Stay well nourished, which, you know, that's true for mitochondrial patients pretty much in managing almost anything. Undernourishment makes mitochondrial symptoms worse. And it can be, as we know, a significant challenge for many patients with mitochondrial disease to stay well nourished. So, you know, work with your child to maximize your nutritional status. And
Maggie, hold on one second.
Sure.
So somebody just beeped in, and we welcome you to the call, but there's some background noise, so if you'll just use *6 for the mute button on your phone, just so that we can continue to hear really well, that'd be great. Thank you. Okay. Thanks, Maggie. Keep on going. Maggie?
Maybe she used *6.
Hello?
Maggie, can you hear us?
Yes. Did I go away for a minute?
You did. But you're back now.
Oh, good. Okay. Sorry about that. And then, you know, try to minimize exposure to heat and help the body stay cool. And some of the really common strategies that people use, you know, air conditioning, swimming if the water's not too hot, fans, those cute little misting fans, you know, that are often sold at amusement parks, cool vests are helpful. I would say that I don't think very many of our patients in this area use them. But I'm really delighted that Nancy's here to talk about cool vests and give some more information about that. But, you know, as always, if you or your child has a new symptom, please don't assume it's just part of having mito. Any new symptom always merits evaluation by you or your child's physician. So I'd love to hear what people's experiences are with the heat and what kind of strategies people have used to cope with it.
Maggie, you gave an excellent overview of the heat intolerance and some of the causes and symptoms of it. I mean, truly, a fantastic overview. So I think that alone was very helpful. And, you know, I guess I would like to open the floor for a minute for further questions about what you talked about, as well as then we'll talk a little bit about strategies for cooling. But before we talk about strategies for cooling, does anybody have questions that they'd like to bring up? And you know, I guess I clarify that we don't always know the answers to the questions, because with many things with mitochondrial disease, we don't completely understand. But we could certainly talk about it. Does anybody have questions related to what Maggie was just explaining so far? Maggie, I have a question that was emailed to me earlier in the day today, and that was about sweating. So when we were on the call last month, Dr. Holtzman did share with us a little bit about abnormal sweating, that some patients can sweat a lot and suddenly for no reason really related to outside or environmental temperature, and some people are unable to sweat at all. This specific question was if there was any experience with that sweating abnormality and L-carnitine. Have you heard of that?
Interesting. You mean actually having a kind of a causal relationship between?
Right. So I guess for this patient in particular, and I wonder if any of you have had this experience also. She had pounding heart, you know, which sounds dysautonomic, getting very warm in the nighttime, being unable to sweat, and when she reduced the L-carnitine, then she found the problem stopped.
I've never heard of that. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I personally don't have any experience with that, and I haven't heard that from any other patient. I mean, that's usually the side effects that we think about with L-carnitine, and as I'm sure many people on the call are aware, are body odor and loose stools, right? I mean, those are sort of the most common thing. I've never heard of that, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Interestingly, this is Darla Klein.
Yeah, go ahead.
Interestingly, when I was treated by Dr. Whiteman for carnitine deficiency when I was pregnant with Sephora, my 4-year-old, I did have the racing heart, that kind of stuff, and, you know, at times I would have, like, heat at night, but I never related it to that. But Dr. Whiteman actually took me off carnitine because it had raised some over the month I took it, but he didn't want me to continue on it because he said it could have actually been the cause. So there, I guess, is an example of possible.
Okay, interesting. Anybody else have issues with nighttime heat intolerance?
Yeah. I don't know. I muted my phone, so I hope it's not too much of an interference. If it is, I can mute it again.
We can hear you fine. Who's
this is Cheryl Berardi.
Okay, hi, Cheryl.
Hi. My family both are diagnosed with mito, and we have always had a problem since we passed the threshold, I would say, and at sweating at nighttime, and it was always affiliated with areas that we had difficulties with or were signs of areas of an infection. But when we are not well, we really sweat. And when we're doing pretty well at nighttime, we don't sweat. And it's sort of mirrored around where the infection site is or the site that's having stress or inflammation. But it's always been a terrible problem for both of us. But I can only relate it to, from our experience for years, is that when our energy level is low, we sweat more. And it seems like the mitochondria or something are generating heat somehow. I don't know. It's just a weird phenomenon. But that's all we know it is a phenomenon. So we do experience that, the both of us, exactly. And I know when I'm getting sick before I'm sick because I start to sweat at nighttime excessively, and spots where, you know, our problematic lymph nodes or the chest, or my son where he had problems with it. His head for years, where, you know, he had declined. It just seems to split wherever there seems to be a weakness, weak spot.
Interesting. And I imagine that some people actually would have the opposite effect if they were unable to split, that they would have an elevated body temperature. It would look like a fever, right?
We get that. I don't know how much asthma and support do, but I know that I go in phases where there are times that I'm absolutely freezing for days, and nothing I do except for a really hot bath gets me warm or, I mean, cool. And then I'll have days where I'm just crying, and I just can't get warm or can't get cool. So, and I definitely have noticed times that I'm not as healthy. I'm more worn down or just not getting as much sleep or something. That those things are worse. I've not really noticed much correlation with the sweating. But I, interestingly, even this morning, Abby was telling me that she's freezing. And we gave her a hot bath because she's so cold, and yet we're here in Iowa, and it's like, it's really warm out. So.
Interesting. Maggie, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I guess I just wanted to add that, you know, I don't think about this so much with sweating, but patients that have a hard time with gut dysmotility, when they're sick, you know, when they have an infection, those issues tend to become more prominent. You know, they really worsen. And that's, you know, that's related to autonomic dysfunction. So I guess it makes sense that some of the sweating stuff would worsen as well.
Interesting. Well, and Maggie, I actually wanted to zone back in a little bit on one point that you brought up that I thought was very good that maybe is not as easily recognized by people who really haven't gotten to know their own mitochondrial disease nuances, and that's that some of the more subtle symptoms can actually flare up and become more apparent as a result of the autonomic dysfunction, which may be worsened by, let's say, warmer weather. And one that you mentioned was gut dysmotility, and another that you mentioned was fatigability and behavioral issues.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Some examples and how you've seen that, as well as I'd like to hear any examples from the group about that.
Well, certainly we have seen, you know, lots of our patients, you know, our young patients, that when they're sick, their behavior just, you know, they can totally decompensate, right, behaviorally. I mean, that's relatively common. It's sort of in the same, I mean, I'm crabby when I'm sick, right, and I don't have mitochondrial disease, but, you know, no one is their best behaviorally when they're ill. And, but I think with patients who have behavioral issues related to, you know, mood disorders or neurologic issues or whatever, those behavioral issues can really become more prominent. And in fact, we certainly have patients that, kids that have a hard time communicating, you know, whether they're truly nonverbal or they just, for whatever reason, have a hard time communicating their needs. You know, it's by watching their behavior that their parents know that they're sick, right? Especially with things that aren't quite so obvious, like maybe a urinary tract infection or where there may not be, unless the child complains, you might not have an obvious sign. But you know, certainly we have patients that behaviorally don't do as well in the summertime. You know, they sort of decompensate, and I think there's definitely a connection there. I don't know if other people on, you know, on the call here notice that as well.
Interesting. Anybody like to comment about that idea?
Oh, I would. I'm from other than Florida. Humidity is just horrible for both of us. But what a lot of people misunderstand is if I'm in a meeting myself, I have to open the door to have some circulation. It might not be real warm to most people, but the bare minimal humidity just is horrible for both of us, more so than outside where there's fresh air. And I know my son, when he was younger, we would go to a physician's office, and a lot of times I thought, and he would just get tired and bored, but it was the closed door, and I realized I always had to open the door and prop the door open wherever I go for him, or else it would just escalate. And we have the same symptoms. I can say that when my behavioral symptoms escalate in that situation, I sympathize with children because you feel like you're suffocating. And I don't know what it is all about, but it feels like it's my head, same as my son. And you almost go into a mode where you're in a survival mode and you will do anything to remove yourself instantly from the environment. So it's not just an uncomfortable thing where some people, I think, mention that they think it's just uncomfortable and you can wait. You feel like you're suffocating and your head is just going to explode from the pressure. And you can feel, I feel it immediately if I walk into a room. And I have to take immediate action to reduce it, or else it's just so severe. And I don't understand all those mechanisms, but it's definitely more so feels neurological and in the brain than that I'm just a little uncomfortable and hot. I don't know what's happening, or if anybody does any kind of pneumonia levels, or if somehow things rise real quickly in the body, or our arteries don't, you know, are slow at propulsing the blood flow. So because you do, you feel like you're just going to totally suffocate.
Well, and do you get a lot of the fatigue issues with that too? Because that's one thing that we noticed. You just wilt. That was a great analogy earlier. Because it's so exhausting. You feel like you've got weight tied to your arms and your legs. You feel like you're just so weak you can't hardly walk, and often we actually find that. And unfortunately with my girls, if they're in the heat for very long, they'll end up having stroke symptoms. So it overwhelms the whole body if you can't keep them cool. And their behavior definitely is going to be affected when they feel, I mean, if their body is getting so overheated that their, you know, neurologic systems go haywire, obviously you're going to see behavioral issues because there's something going on pretty bad. So.
I think what I explained is more of the part where humidity plays a role versus just heat. The heat seems to affect us the same way, but at a slower pace, and depending on what level we are metabolically, if we're doing really well, we tolerate more. But when it is associated with humidity in a closed room, it is an immediate, it's not a slow, progressive type thing. It's immediate. And I don't know what that's all about, but I guess because, you know, the humidity is very different than the heat for us. It's much, much more severe.
I have difficulty with indoor environments, too. And what I found, this is Kathy Graff, I've actually had to leave several jobs because of building thickness. That, like you say, even if the temperature is more harsh or severe outdoors, I tend to feel better outdoors than indoors. So for me, there's something about the fresh air that seems to override the actual temperature and humidity. You know, like you were saying, like if you have like a fresh, some fresh air coming in from outside, or if you can actually go outdoors, a lot of times I feel better. And I do get that cramped in and just feeling like there's something terribly wrong. It's really hard to put a finger on it, but it's,
it just feels like
it's been happening for a long time.
You can't keep it. You're just suffocating. But when the airflow is there, I just blow a fan on me immediately. Sometimes at work, if I start to get a little humid or something. But without that, it would be devastating.
So it goes back to what Maggie said at the beginning, is that knowing yourself or your child and having a plan. Because this makes me think also that, for example, when parents are planning for their plans in their school with their children, this needs to be part of the strategy, is the idea that heat and humidity is really hard to tolerate, and that the idea that it could be too late if you wait till the point where either the you feel symptomatic or, you know, you already feel hot to try to then figure out what to do about it, that we need to be proactive about that. Let's talk about some strategies for keeping cool. And Nancy, I'm going to let you chime in a little bit at this point. Maggie mentioned misting the skin, and I think the idea is, especially if the patient and the child is unable to sweat, then we want to emulate sweating that same way so that we can have evaporation happening on the skin. And water, you know, helps with that quite a bit on the skin. But let's talk about both your suggestions, and Nancy, I'll let you just speak up for a minute and talk a little bit about the idea of a cooling technology and what's involved in keeping the body cool and why certain things work.
Okay. You know, nature has the perfect cooling system, which is evaporation. Unfortunately, there are things that interfere with it, like humidity and that kind of thing. And, misting your body, obviously, what that's going to do is it creates artificial perspiration. Because as you perspire, when the water evaporates into the air, it's just nature's way of cooling you. The best part of evaporation is as that water evaporates, it actually pulls excess heat out of your body. Which, you know, in many cases, it's not a matter of walking around saying, oh, I feel so cool with this vest on. That's really not the intended thing for the cooling vest, our cooling vest, which cools through evaporation. It's keeping the body temperature normal, or as close to normal as you can possibly do it. Possibly can. And with evaporation, that's what happens. Our best, what you do with our best, like I said, we use evaporative cooling. So our best is designed so that it will only soak up so much water per square inch. So it's not, you know, if you stuck it in the bathtub and you left it there overnight, you would only want to hold basically, you know, 2 cups of water maybe. For the children, you know, a half a cup to a cup of water is all you need to get that vest charged up and going. But that water's trapped in an inner core of the vest, and as the environment pulls the water out of the vest, it pulls excess heat out of the body, so that you remain at a normal body temperature. Your body temperature, your core temperature, is not going to spike all the time. You're one, you know, I hear everyone talking about humidity, and unfortunately, you know, there are instances where our vest is not the solution. If you're in Florida, and we're located in Alabama, so I can speak about humidity too. So you're in a situation where it's, you know, it's 99 degrees and it's 100% humidity. Well, what happens is there's nowhere for the water in that vest to evaporate. There's nowhere for the water on your body to evaporate, so you just hold on to that water. So, you know, our vest does have some limitations. Anytime you get to probably about 90%, 85 to 90% humidity, you're going to see a decrease in the cooling power of the vest. There are other ways, I'm sure, other technologies are out there for cooling the body. Some of them are gel packs that you put in the refrigerator. You take them out and you put them against your body. Some people will actually use ice, which, you know, really sends a very negative signal to your brain. Instantly, ice will cool your skin temperature immediately. And it, like I said, it's a false signal. So it sends a signal to your brain that says, oh, you're cold. And your body temperature actually goes up. So, you know, I don't understand exactly what it is that the parents are finding. You know, I know how the vest works and that it is cooling the heat out of the body. But when I talk to the parents, they really act as if, you know, it's given the kids, it's just a whole new lease on life. Or, you know, they're allowed to go outside for a longer period of time. They're at school and they can go outside with the kids when they're at school, things like that. thought, we've tried our best. It seems like most of the children, and I know I'm concentrating on children, but I hear more from parents with children with MIDO than I do from adults with MIDO.
That may change, Nancy. So
I picked that up on the call, which is
so funny. I think maybe it was just that's just too new that you existed, and that's part of why I wanted to invite you today, was so that for the adults who feel that they can't do their shopping in the summertime because you can't handle the heat on the parking lot pavement, you know, I'm hoping that this is worth trying for them also.
You know, I know that the people that are in this group are, you know, you suffer to a much more serious extent, but we talk to people every day. I mean, you know, just run-of-the-mill healthy individuals who just cannot follow. And, you know, it all boils down to the same thing. And you know, even with the healthy people, you know, you get the same effect. You know, I'm tired. I'm listless. I just don't feel like I can do anything. The humidity is stifling. If I have to go outside one more time, you know. So, you know, the heat is a problem for a lot of people, but in particular for you. What we've tried to do, in particular for the children, is they came in all different sizes, so we've set things up on the internet so that if we can get the correct measurements, the child's measurements, we can make a vest that fits them. Some kids are long and thin, and some kids are you know, wide and short.
Could I ask a question? Is this vest worn against the skin, like under outer clothing, or is it an outer garment?
Well, we make it so it is pretty much an outer garment, but you can put, you know, a lightweight, breathable shirt on top of it. If you want to be in a situation where no one knows you're wearing a cooling vest.
Oh, peer pressure.
Well, you know, but at the same time, you know, you put, typically it is much more comfortable if you put a t-shirt or some type of garment on and then put the vest over top of it.
The other thought that I had too is, like, is it possible that the fact that the moisture is evaporating out of the vest and the person doesn't have to sweat enough, that maybe it keeps the electrolytes in better balance than if you had to sweat excessively?
Mm-hmm. We provide cooling garments for the people who work at the Yuma Proving Grounds. And in the United States, that's said to be the hottest place in the United States. It's, you know, it resembles a desert. And, you know, for the soldiers, how equipment's going to work. Those guys can only get, but the heat is so severe there, and the evaporation takes place so quickly that those guys can only wear a vest for maybe 2 hours and have to wet it down again. And I was there at one point in time, and, you know, I was talking to some people, and they said, well, you know, the way we look at it is that if the environment's going to suck out 2 cups of water out of this vest, if I didn't have the vest on, it's going to get it out of me. And that's true. It's good, you know, the environment does, you know, not only is the water on your skin when you mist yourself going to evaporate, but the environment, depending on how severe it is, it's going to drain your body of fluids very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Other questions that we have for Nancy, as well as other suggestions to share with the group about ways to keep cool in the warmer temperatures?
Yeah, I have one question. What do you have a recommendation for children that do not like the wet feel against their skin because it's like sensory issues?
The vest really is not wet. The best way to activate a vest is to stick it in a plastic bag. And for a child, like I said, you would need no more than about a cup of water. Put that water in there and leave it in there for 15, 20 minutes so it soaks up all that water and lets it migrate through. When you take it out, the vest is, you know, the outer part of the vest is going to feel a little damp. If it bothers the inner part of the vest, you know, we
have one, but my girls are just, they just don't like the damp feel, the cold feel. even though it does help them, they don't like the feel.
I was wondering how heavy it is. Is it heavy at all?
No, it's not.
No. Okay.
It depends on your skin. But my girl's skin, I think so, but it's, you know.
Wait, is this one of our vests?
Pretty positive.
Is it?
Yep.
The vest itself weighs, especially for a child, or an adult's vest weighs less than a pound. And then, you know, an adult's vest will usually take a cup and a half to 2 cups of water.
I'm probably putting too much water in.
Yeah, you may be, because like I said, that may be why they feel wet. If you just, like I said, if you just give it a little bit more time in the very beginning with, you know, a cup and a half of water, and
I'm pretty sure my instructions said like 2 cups. But if you're thinking for children, they only need half a cup to...
But, you know, once that vest starts, you know, drying a little bit, another thing that you could do, too, is to wet it and then, you know, hang it for a little while before they put it on.
Yeah.
It will basically feel dry, but it still will work. It's still going to be working. So they're relatively lightweight.
Other questions and suggestions to talk about?
I don't know if Silver Outfitters makes it, but back in the days where I was told I probably had multiple sclerosis instead, they used to make other types too, like cooling wrists, wrist wraps or neck wraps, things like that. And I actually got a neck wrap, and I really felt like that really helped me. Because I find it really hard to be out when it's warm. It's just exhausting, and I'm one of those people that doesn't want to go shopping, doesn't want to go anywhere because it's just too hot, and I just get so fatigued. But one thing I definitely have found for my girl, besides using like cooling vests or things like that, is the biggest thing is hydration. We use Gatorade every single day. We found that works better than any type of liquid for us, and it just saved them from hospitalization or just a lot of things, because if they get dehydrated or overheated, then it's like hospitalization with C10 or something. Hydration is very important, we found.
We made some neck wraps. We've got some new ones coming out this year that are just fabulous. But the one thing that the neck wraps and the wrist wraps is, you know, the theory. I think the theory behind it is always as the blood goes through those areas, it cools the blood. It produces a feel good cool. Oh, I feel good. I feel this. Where those putting cooling products in those areas really doesn't help to eliminate the heat that's in the body. It doesn't do much to draw that heat out.
I'm talking about in combination with the cooling bath.
Yeah, it does feel really good. Yeah, and we wear neck wraps right here all the time. Just because they feel great, and they do make you feel good.
But it's the evaporative, I guess, cooling
it's
really helpful.
Actively drawing that heat out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
The body core.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Do you find this is covered by insurance?
We work with a lot of people who, you know, a lot of people whose insurance does cover it. We don't file insurance claims from here. It's simply because we just don't have the knowledge to do it. Most people will get a prescription from their doctor, and then when they get the invoice from us where they have paid for a cooling vest, they'll send the two of those together to the insurance company, and depending on your insurance, it depends on how much they reimburse you.
And how much do they run approximately?
We have a variety of vests. We have some that start at $60 and then at $65, and then we jump up to about
$95. Okay.
So Nancy, why don't you share the web address also?
Sure. It's www.coolingapparel.com. Cooling Apparel. And we have, all types of products. A lot of times, I know that this is going to sound way out there, but as a recovery method, maybe it would help. Maggie was talking in the beginning about, plan ahead and make sure you have some recovery time and you're going to have to rest. And I've heard other people say that, they get deadly ill, they come in. One of the products that we have, which is probably one of the most effective products we have, is a helmet, is a hard hat liner. And we make it for the construction industry. But for recovery purposes, or even, if you're very heat intolerant, you could wear it underneath another hat. That product works so well to help draw the heat out of the body because it sits very snugly on the head. We have sold these to hospitals that use them instead of using cooling blankets in the emergency room. They'll buy these, keep these on hand, just run them under the faucet, wring it out, put it on the head, and it really is very effective for drawing excess heat out very quickly.
That's interesting, huh?
And would putting a damp cloth on the head basically do the same?
Yeah.
That'd be kind of like the quick, an idea, just if you were in a situation. I personally remember when my daughter, before we even had diagnosis, we were out at an amusement park in the summertime, and she was beet red, and I had no idea why, because I didn't know she had mitochondrial disease. But I took, a burp cloth and stuck it in one of the wishing wells and laid it on her head, because I just intuitively knew that I had to cool her down, and there was no place I could take her. And,
chances are that was not really real cold water. You don't have to have real cold water for evaporation to work. And, it's just water, and then once the air hits that water, it just begins to cool.
Other questions and other ideas that people can share about what has helped them in, as far as the strategy goes? And Maggie, do you have any additional comments after hearing some of this discussion as well?
I think I'm really interested in learning this about, this information about the cooling vests, because as I said, we do have some patients that use them, but I don't believe very many. It's just fascinating. I mean, if that's something that enables people to be outside for, even if it just extends people's outside time a little bit in the summertime, that's a huge issue, especially with kids,
mm-hmm.
That oftentimes aren't able to play outside as much as they would wish. So, can I bring something up? Nancy, I was very interested when you say, it actually cools you down too much and it trips your body into trying to heat up more. One of my coping strategies for the summer is I still drink hot liquids in the summer. I drink hot tea, or if I drink water, I usually have it at room temperature. It seems to me if I drink iced drinks or eat stuff that's really cold, it actually makes me feel worse.
But
I have a hot beverage, and I feel warm, and then it seems like that brings on sweat, and I actually cool down faster. Anybody else, or is this a tactic anyone else uses? Or maybe Maggie could comment on the physiology and stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems it's sort of mixed in because I might have to go very soon, but I wanted to ask Maggie, or I get confused about the autonomic nervous system issue and how that's diagnosed, or I guess it's suspected, because it's our experiences with humidity, especially in closed rooms, it's immediate. I mean, it's not like my body has time to get warm, it's like this immediate. I don't know if it's related to barometric pressure, too, because I know it seems like in the evening when the sun goes down, there's immediate release,
Well, most of our patients that have significant dysautonomia, those, they're typically sort of diagnosed and managed by a neurologist who has particular expertise and interest in this area, and or a cardiologist, you know, for patients that have significant heart rate and blood pressure changes. So I don't have a lot of experience with what you're describing in a closed room. I guess it sort of makes sense if you feel better when you get sort of a cool breeze or just have some air movement.
It's pressure on my whole, we feel on our whole body, but really seems to affect our brain, which makes it very, very irritable quite quickly.
Does that sound like an anxiety attack, maybe?
No.
If you ruled that out, then I'd take it.
No. You can physically see it. I mean, I will hear it where I can't talk. I mean, my neurological symptoms just decrease.
And have you had that evaluated by a neurologist?
No, but it's my son and I both. We both react the same way. But it's humidity. People talk a lot about the heat, and the heat definitely affects us and is not good for us. But the humidity is just so much more severe than just the heat in itself. And that confuses people. They think because you're indoors and they have the air conditioner set at 76, 78, which is warm, that's a better environment than outside where there's, you know, just a little bit of heat. And they think they confuse heat with sun. Well, he's out of the sun in the shade. It's still really humid, you know. So there just seems to be confusion about the definition of what heat is and heat versus humidity. And
symptoms, do you get a lot of, like, dizziness or just, like, off-balance feeling or just really feeling very weird, too? Or is it just really fatigue? And you said because it affects your speech and things like that.
Just your whole body just starts to go down.
Yeah.
Crash.
Yeah,
a severe crash.
I've had that.
It's very immediate, you know.
I tend to get that kind of like in church settings where there's a lot of people around or crowded places, and it is hot. I've had that quite a few times, and it's to the point where you just got to get out of the room.
That's been my experience too.
You're just, you know, just, I don't know. It is. It's a weird feeling.
Feels like a suffocating type feeling. For the kids, and you almost get into a survival mode where you just need air. You just need air. And I just think about the children.
Yeah, I've not, you know, my children, I have no idea because they're young enough that they're not really communicating to me what all they're dealing with. We're starting to see some things with my 8-year-old now, but I've definitely had things like that before. Not frequently, thankfully. I used to have a lot more symptoms in the 90s, but since we've moved into a central air-conditioned house, I've not had as many problems. But I do notice that if you know, some of the same symptoms you're talking about when I'm in an enclosed environment.
I would think that a situation like that would be really difficult for children on the school bus.
Mm.
You know?
Horrible, right?
Oh, and noisy and gasoline fumes on top.
Well, just that in terms of, and so I would think that it would be really important to always, you know, for the kids on the bus, I'm not sure, you know, you would need to kind of think about that, because that might be beyond the scope of the IEP if you're not thinking about the school bus. But I have heard parents tell me that they think that their child is having such a bad day at school, but it's actually that school bus ride home in the warmer temperatures that is making them just completely decompensate and be a mess and wilted and behaviorally falling apart when they get off the bus. And it may have nothing to do with the school day.
We actually requested air conditioning school bus, and that is provided, and with his peers. But my son doesn't ride it anymore because it is a very stressful middle school, or depending on your neighborhood, I guess. But that had helped. They do have air conditioned buses, and I think it's going to be more and more in the future that it's going to be the norm.
And it seems that then, likewise, when you're thinking about you know, it's going to be really important to cool the car down before, you know, getting in, right?
Absolutely.
Let that AC run a little bit before getting in.
Is the automatic starter for that? No.
use it to cool us. The coldness in the winter doesn't bother me, but I always use it in the summer.
To get that, you know, to get that cooling down a little bit so that, from what I understand from hearing these experiences and even seeing it with my own daughter, and Maggie, I'd be interested in what you have heard from patients in your experience, is that it is quick, that the decompensation and the progressiveness of how the person feels and the deterioration of kind of the rapid onset of their symptoms can happen pretty quickly, that it doesn't take 6 hours out in the heat for them to start to feel bad as it might would with a person who is just getting overheated over time, that this can happen pretty quickly.
Well, yeah, especially, I think that's right, and especially depending on kind of how severe the patient's disease is and what their other symptoms are. You know, like if they're a little bit dehydrated anyway, and, you know, maybe they're not feeling totally up to snuff, and, you know, the more of those sort of additive factors you have, I'm guessing that would make it that much faster, you know, to feel really lousy. But then, you know, there are some patients with mitochondrial disease that are, you know, bothered by this somewhat, but not as dramatically as other patients. You know, it seems to me that it's a little bit like so many other mitochondrial disease symptoms where there's really a spectrum, you know, of severity. But again, that's just my clinical impression.
I wanted to bring up a great point that Nancy and I had talked about before when she and I were, you know, talking before I was inviting her to be a part of our call today, and that's that on coolingapparel.com. I think you can look at the vest now, and Nancy was telling me about how she has been able to customize the vest to include a place for a G-tube and even a pocket in the back for you know, the formula. So, Nancy, you want to talk just a minute about that just so that we can pass that information along?
Yeah, sure. You know, again, you know, it just stems from one person's need. You know, I was totally unaware that you know, so many children were dependent upon, you know, this equipment. And, you know, she starts talking about, you know, well, can I put a backpack on here and will it still cool? Yes, you can put a backpack on there and it will still cool. And I realized what her purpose was. So for the children that do have this, carry the equipment with them, we've got a way of putting a small pouch on the back that will hold the feeding equipment. And then, you know, they've got it with them. And they're ready to go.
That's wonderful. Yeah, especially when you think of how hot those backpacks are.
Yeah, the backpack, you know, with all that equipment, you know, it might limit the airflow that's going through right at that one point, but it certainly doesn't deteriorate the cooling process at all, really. So it was just a solution. And it seems to work. Probably 50% of all the children's vests we make have patches on them.
You made two for us with pouches.
Are they working well for you?
Yeah, they work good. My 4-year-old has 24-hour tube feeding, so it's, you know, for us, it's made it a lot easier than trying to fit a backpack over top of the vest.
Right.
It's been a good solution.
Well, good.
I just wanted to say hi.
Hi.
I've been on board 20 minutes. This is Jenna. I hear Nancy and Darla and Christine. I don't know who else is here.
So Jenna is the person who started this whole phenomenon, right, Jenna? So, well, Jenna, you are an example of why sometimes in our interaction we get a lot done, because it just takes somebody who goes, I'm just going to do this, you know, I'm just going to call and figure it out.
Jenna is actually the person who said to me, you need the TC. So Jenna's really the one who educated me to begin with for this whole thing. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for dealing with all of us and being willing to work it out and make it work for a bunch of kids and, you know, improve our kids' lives.
So any other, we're going to start to wrap up a little bit, and I just want to share a little minor action news. It's towards the end of our call, but any other additional questions or comments?
I have a question, because I missed a lot. I've only been on for like 20 minutes here. But what temperature do you guys find that your kids can do? I mean, we're trying to write out, you know, for details in our 504 plan for school. And I'm not quite sure what to put.
Can I put it back to the last part? But that gets real confusing because we keep our house at 70 degrees. It's 71, I know it. But it all seems to be dependent for us, anyhow, what the humidity level is.
Right.
I mean, that humidity starts the temperature. And I know the school system keeps sometimes the room temperatures, you know, a little warmer to conserve. And we've had fans put in, which was very, very helpful if they weren't willing to put down the temperatures. But there is a temperature, it's for us, we know, but also that affects it is the humidity for that day. So that makes it difficult for us to put that down.
I guess that makes sense. I guess you really just have to watch her, but, you know, if they're not, until they get to know her, you know.
Sure.
Her problem is she doesn't really, like, sweat at all. I mean, she's a tiny, tiny, tiny bit. And otherwise, she'll just run a fever if she gets over here.
Mm-hmm. Well, if Rachel's like Sephora and everything else, or in this area, it could be a problem knowing a certain temperature because one of the things I was mentioning earlier is we go in kind of fluctuating between, you know, times where we're overheated and it can last for several days sometimes, and then other times we'll be, like, freezing all the time. So it's
yeah.
it's so
exactly.
You never know what to expect. I don't know, a temperature, if they're expecting a certain temperature, that may be pretty hard for you to figure out.
Well, they want me to write it down for recess.
Well, when you work with
I just wanted to mention this. And this is just sort of a general caution that we use here in metabolism with the floating. We do not specify either for temperature or for humidity because in our school letter and certainly when I talk with school personnel, we provide sort of general guidelines about you know, various aspects of mitochondrial disease, including autonomic dysfunction and how that, you know, affects the child and, you know, keeping a comfortable ambient temperature and all that sort of stuff. But really what we try to encourage, and I know this is can be extremely challenging, but we really try to encourage the family and the school to work together positively as much as possible because what we found is that when and a lot of this, you know, sometimes it's a matter of luck and what school system you're in and all of that. But when the school system can really get to know the child and when the family can educate the school personnel about that particular child's symptoms and what to watch for, and they can become more attuned to what the child's needs are, you know, and how to read them, that's far more helpful.
Exactly. Well, they had asked me for a temperature, and I said, well, I don't know because, like I said, I mean, like everything else, it depends on so many things. It depends on, you know, if she's hydrated, her overall status.
Right. And also because sometimes what we found is when people have kind of begged and wanted a specific temperature, that what sometimes ends up happening is that then there can be these back and forth. Okay, well, if 79 is okay, is 80 okay? Well, what if it's not very humid? Well, is it okay for it to be 81? Or, you know, and it's just, you go down this road that's just,
yeah.
But sometimes people really are stuck, and I certainly appreciate that. You know, I mean, sometimes even with people's best efforts, it's hard to have a really positive relationship with the school system. So, you know, but that's our general approach.
That's very helpful.
And, you know, Christine mentioned, like, she noticed with Eva that she was getting flushed. And I've seen that in some adult patients, too. But, and then you mentioned the, you know, when the behavioral issues. Is there kind of a list of things that you could give either to the school or maybe, you know, work with at home that, like, typical signs of when the heat intolerance is getting to be a little bit too much?
Yeah, she can't walk.
Oh, let me just...
I'm also thinking of it, and she can't walk.
Like, do you notice any other behavioral changes before the know, she totally gets that. You know, stuff like that. Maybe some subtle stuff that, you know, like you as a parent would pick up on that maybe a professional wouldn't notice right away in the school environment.
Yeah, I think coloring is definitely a good one. When they start getting lobster red, she usually get lobster red and then her legs will start giving out.
Right. What other are the first signs that you all would report? Because what I think is neat also about having a call that combines both the clinical experience as well as the parents and the adult patients is that, you know, we all bring together these different views that give us such a better big picture perspective than if we were just talking to other parents, if we were just talking to a group of clinicians, if we were just talking to the adults, right? Because we can verbalize those symptoms and our experiences so differently and put it together into one really holistic perspective. So I'd love to hear a couple thoughts on what are some of the first signs and symptoms that you see that really are clues about the heat intolerance. And then we're going to start to wrap up. So go ahead and jump in about that.
I just start to lose energy and then feel like I'm going to faint. It usually comes on pretty fast for me. And now my other symptoms seem to get worse.
Do other people notice a change in your appearance or anything when this is starting to happen?
People can just tell I don't look right, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I've become pale or I can just. I guess I just start to slow down and everything, so.
Yeah, and I think for some people, maybe it's like maybe you're having more difficulty concentrating or.
Definitely.
Or maybe starting to have speech problems.
Mm-hmm. I think a good point is that, and Maggie confirmed this for me, if you don't mind, power as well as flushing. So you could be pale or you could be red.
Yes.
Right? So it's hard to really say.
Right.
One versus the other.
Right. And I think it's all part of knowing yourself or knowing your child and being, you know, I mean, I think we always find that the patients or parents are the best at describing, you know, their own symptomatology and, you know, just how things work for their body. So, but yeah, absolutely, palate or flushing.
I mean, I think the thing that we do is just we don't wait. We try waiting is really hard. It's almost not a good idea, whereas I know some people, if they don't have the symptoms and their child has the symptoms, even think, well, okay, it's just another 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes, but each minute, at least in our experience, we're exposed to something that's drawing us down is severe. So, and I know a lot of people come to Orlando to go to Disneyland, with Make-A-Wish, and my little kids seem to get those wishes a lot. But I know from a couple of friends, you try to warn people about water if they're not familiar with it, the heat and humidity. But after their experience, their children had really deteriorated and were never the same because it was just such a learning experience. And, you know, they sort of pushed themselves like everybody does on vacation sometimes, and it was really sad because they weren't informed until they lived through it. You know what I'm saying?
I wish I had a tape recording of myself saying, please don't go to Disneyland except in the wintertime. We say it like
this
over and over and over again.
If I can interject something, and like I work with, you know, our primary markets are consumer markets, people who are out having fun. So, but I have talked to many people who have had heat stress, a severe form of heat stress or a heat stroke, and their bodies have never recovered from it. They are always, from that point on, will always be susceptible to heat stroke.
And those are,
you put that so well.
People who are otherwise healthy.
Otherwise healthy, exactly.
Wow. I think it's hard sometimes as a parent to say when. I find that with my girls because they don't know when it's too much. You know, you have to, you know, get them inside, get them hydrated. Even with relatives, it can be really frustrating because they're like, well, you know, air is good for them. Being outside's good. So what's it going to do to them, et cetera?
Oh, yeah.
So you really have to kind of have a plan ahead of time. Know, okay, this is how much time we're going to do and stick with it, no matter what other people around say, including the child or if it's yourself, because I know I've paid many times, just got to do one more thing, and then, you know, for the next, I don't know how long, days, weeks, I'm just exhausted and paying for it, or the kids, unfortunately, you know, it's too easy to want them to have, you know, fun like the other kids, and so.
Well, I thank you all for contributing on this. I think that, in my experience, the idea of dysautonomia is one that not all people with mitochondrial disease recognize that some of their symptoms could be related to the dysautonomia, so they might just think that it's something bizarre that only happens to them. So part of my goal is to get the word out so that you can be a little bit more proactive in helping to know yourself and in recognizing what's going on, and then also to understand what some of those symptoms are so they don't feel so confusing. Because as Maggie mentioned earlier, and as we talked about in April's meeting with Dr. Holtzman, the dysautonomia symptoms can be some of the most distressing symptoms that the person with mitochondrial disease experiences. So that can be even more troublesome if you just don't understand why it's happening. Nancy, I'm going to ask you to share your phone number also for those people who may not have internet access, if you would. And then we're going to wrap up and thank both of you for being on the call today. So go ahead, Nancy, if you'll just say the phone number where, again, the website was coolingapparel.com. And Nancy, how about the phone number if they want to call?
Okay, the toll-free number is 888-672-6963.
Great, thank you.
And you know, we'll help any way we can. Like I said, we often in them. We don't understand the disease as well as you, so when you call, you know, what you tell us is important because, you know, we have a learning curve here.
Well, Nancy, I think that the fact that you were willing to be a part of this call today and to listen and learn, I know for me, helps me feel like you're advocating for our MITO community also, and I thank you for that. And Maggie, it goes without saying that you're advocating for the MITO community every day. And for those of you who don't know, Maggie is always busy in the clinic and also is on the Medical Advisory Committee for MITO Action and has been since the beginning. And so we really are just indebted to her for her daily service that she does for all of us. So please help me to thank you both of them.
Well, it's really been a pleasure to participate, and I'm very glad to do so.
Thank you to both of you. Yeah.
The website is phenomenal. I know you introduced somebody that does the website. I just want to say thank you so much.
Well, that's great to know. So that's Kathy.
Well, that wasn't me. I'm more the administrator.
Well,
I do stuff behind the scenes. The outward appearance somebody else takes the credit for.
Well, the fact that it works. We can give Kathy some credit for that. How about that part? So, you know, because the fact that it works, we can say Kathy, and also Kathy is the one who really helped me and got me up and running on the blog, which is where then you go and you can kind of see some of our more, you know, discussion-oriented information. If you haven't checked that out, it's blogs.mydirection.org, and we've got info about the autism debate as well as summaries from all of these monthly meetings. And if you click on the categories, you can see the summaries, and then you can also find the audio file to listen to right there. And that's thanks to Kathy for that. So thank you for bringing that up, because that helps me to thank her, because like I mentioned earlier, with Lisa going out of her way to do some awareness events, and Kathy doing things for the web, and Maggie being on the Medical Advisory Committee and being on this call today, you know, at MITO Action, I'm the only paid staff person, and we accomplish so much just with the passion and the drive of people who are, who care about making the quality of life a little better for people with mitochondrial disease, and that's just so empowering and exciting for me, so thank you, guys. for doing that. I wanted to remind everybody about our new diagnosis support group, which happens next Friday, so that's every month on the second Friday of the month. Same time, same place, so same phone number as you use today. Again, at noon Eastern time. That's a open group, no RSVP required and so forth, but it's for those people who are either going through a diagnosis or who are in limbo land of diagnosis where they have either a suspected or an unspecified and, you know, are in that kind of frustrating position. It's just a chance, not as structured as what we had today, just a chance to be together on the phone and kind of share your experiences and know that you're not alone with what you're going through and to help each other. And Anne Reckling, who is the author of the G-Tube book that we have, When Jeremy Jones' Stomach Stopped Working, and who is a psychologist and has a son with mitochondrial disease, will be leading that group. So if you have any questions about that or anything else, you can email me directly at director@mitoaction.org. Does anybody else have any additional announcements they'd like to make?
Well, you can also put a blurb in for your Mito 411 as well.
Okay, that's a great idea, Darla. So Darla actually was a volunteer in the month of April for our Mito 411, which is our toll-free support. And I guess there's two parts that I would say about that. One is the number, if you need somebody to talk to, is 888-MITO-411. And that just connects you up with a hotline where you leave a message, and then volunteers who've gone through our MITO 411 training process will call you back. And the whole purpose is just so that somebody who walks the walk and understands what it means and can connect with you, and we can share resources and listen to one another and just give support, because it's awfully hard to start at the beginning and explain what it means to have MITO and then get to the real issue that's just causing you trouble. So it's both for resources as well as just for that emotional support. Sometimes you have a bad day, and sometimes you're actually having a bad phase in your life. And so that's always there. And we need volunteers to be a part of that also. We need people who are willing to take the calls for a month. There's usually about 3 to 10 calls a month. It kind of depends. And you receive those calls via email. So you get a voicemail on your email, and then your obligation as one of the volunteers is to return that phone call within 24 hours. So it's not very invasive, and you don't have to literally be waiting up all night by the phone to hear if it's going to ring. It's a great system, actually. But we go through about an hour-long training over the phone in order to get you up to speed on what really is involved with being a volunteer, so that we're all on the same page. And if you have any interest in doing that, it's a great way to give back without having to be overcommitted. Darla, you had a great experience this month, I think, doing that. And I would encourage you guys to do that. And I usually put what the times are for the trainings in the newsletter, but it's typically the third Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. and the third Friday of the month at 10 a.m. Those are Eastern times that we have those trainings. But if you want more details, keep an eye out for the newsletter or email me, and I can make sure that I, you know, get you the exact dates for the month and so forth.
You were very patient with me. I was in the hospital with one kid, and then that one got out, and the other one went in, and so it took me a while to get into that class.
That's why I have them every month, so that, you know, it's just ongoing, so that you can jump in any time. But I encourage you guys to do that. It's a great way to help others who, you know, how hard it is to be in this position sometimes. So thank you. Any other announcements that anybody would like to say?
I would just like to make a comment. I don't know if this would be appropriate or not, but I understand the diagnosis of dysautonomia, but if I'm just wondering if there's more research going on to confirm and see if there's other things going on that affect us with heat and humidity, because it doesn't seem to fit all the time and all the people. But you know, it's sort of just concerning when somebody has a problem with teeth, and it's always just on a no-no when you wonder, like the nurse said, you know, is it hard or is it, I mean, I'm always concerned if ammonia levels rise real quick or like the acid rises real quick or if there's something else going on, like a differential diagnosis, I guess, for the same similar symptoms.
I don't know of anything. Maggie, do you know of anything further than just understanding dysautonomia there? Maggie? She may have jumped off because I know she had this afternoon. I don't know of anything further. I mean, from Dr. Holtzman's comments last month on dysautonomia and everything that I have really tried to dig into and then discussing it with Dr. Corson, who's also on our board, I have not heard of anything further, Cheryl. But if I do, I certainly will write about it and let you know.
They don't really know how they're related, do they? The dysautonomia and the mitochondrial and how that works? I don't think they have any idea other than that it's just, it happens.
Right, they explain something. Thank you, because you know, we wonder if there's not something else going on besides that.
Dr. Holtzman spoke last month, and he does a lot of research, actually, specifically with mitochondria in the clinical setting. And he was saying the mitochondria, we know, are related to some of the body functions. So, for example, the mitochondria have to work to generate heat, to warm the body. But the exact understanding of the connection, it was not completely clear. But we know that the mitochondria help, because they're so integral in the body function for so many things, like heart rate and body temperature and so forth, that there is a relationship there, but...
heat, because they produce heat. They turn like a turbine and produce heat, right?
They produce the heat.
It's just curious, I'm thinking out of the box.
No, that's good. It's us who are the patient and, you know, community who will likely be the ones who, I think, you know, make the advances to help bring the understanding. And I think the doctors who are really good with their patients would agree with that. So that's where we start. All right, everybody, I'm going to wrap us up. I'm going to post a summary about this as well as the audio recording, hopefully this afternoon, on the blog, and please share that with your friends and your groups that you're a part of so that we can help as many people as possible to get a better understanding about the topic.
Is there another way to be able to get recordings of things? My computer can't download them off the internet. I still don't have April. I really want to hear the dysautonomia one, but I wasn't able to come.
So, Kathy, would you help me answer that question? I'm not a techie person.
We discussed it with another volunteer before about making some of these recordings available by CD-ROM. That, you know, it could be like an audio recording or MP3 files or whatever format your computer could handle. But the volunteer I talked to actually had equipment to burn them in mass, you know, to mass produce them. That's something I think maybe Kristen, we got to talk to you about to the board or whoever we need to talk to about. You know, we are starting to collect a fairly sizable library of these recordings, and Chrissy's bringing in a lot more stuff too. And you know, we have all those videos that are up on YouTube, but some people can't get to them.
Well, I have dial-up.
Well, I do too. I'll tell you, it's worse than that. It can be worse. My brother does not even use dial-up where he lives.
Oh.
He commutes to Phoenix, and he uses the internet at his office.
Yeah, I just wanted to find out how to get it.
I think it's a good idea. We should have some alternate means of distributing our materials, because we do cater to a wide audience, and there are a lot of people who could use the help who just don't have good infrastructure where they live.
But Jenna, if I sent it to you as an attachment, you still aren't able to open it on your computer.
I might be able to open it if it's an attachment. Well, I don't know.
It'll be
it takes so long to download the file that my computer shuts off before.
Okay, so it kicks you off, but it times out before it's saved.
Yeah, and I can stop that from timing out, but then I can't, I don't know, it hasn't worked so far.
Okay, so,
anyway.
Jenna, what I would suggest that you do, because I actually have the actual copy of it, I mean, I have the digitally the MP3 file, it's not just on the website, is, and Kathy can tell me how to do this, is email me with your address, and I'll just burn it onto a CD and mail it to you. And then, and I'll actually burn several, and then you'll have a hard copy.
Okay. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, and these are in the form of MP3 files, so you will need an MP3 player on your computer as well.
Yeah, that's fine. It's just a matter of trying to download it. That doesn't really work.
I
can understand it would time out, right? It would time out. So,
right.
If you can play it right off your computer, then hopefully that'll work. Kathy,
that works
fine.
You
can work with me later and walk me through
and
maybe have it.
And I actually have more problems with downloads timing out as email attachments than I have downloading them through a web browser.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, it really depends, like, on your ISP and your connection and your computer and a bunch of things. But we can certainly get it to you in another form.
Yeah, send me your address, Jim, and Kathy and I'll work on getting it onto a CD so we can mail it to you.
We'll send you the whole shooting match.
That's right.
All right, well, fill it.
Okay, hours of fun, okay? Great. Any other questions or party comments? All right, perfect. Thank you guys so much for being here. If you are not already, which I hope that you all are, but if you're not already getting our e-newsletter, or if you haven't received one lately, then you might be getting them caught in your spam filter, so do double check. You can do that right off the website. Just click on the Join Us, and there's no fee, obviously, to join. You're just subscribing to the news, and I send out summaries as well as, you know, other topic-related information, trying to be super helpful for, you know, helping all of us to learn as much as we can about the disease. So be sure that you're up to date on that, and feel free always to contact me directly at director@mitoaction.org. So thank you so much, and I appreciate all of you, and stay cool. We'll be maybe take some photos of all of us in our cooling vests and put them up with the meeting summary today. So thanks, you guys. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Katie.